The third case set for appeal this morning is Austin McGee versus Spencer Quarries in the state of South Dakota Department of Transportation. For appellants, we have James Moore, who will be arguing, Jacob Schneider and Chris Grabney are also appearing. For the appellee McGee, we have Ron Parsons Jr., who will be arguing, and Mike Marlowe is also appearing at council table. With that, Mr. Moore, you may proceed with your initial argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, James Moore on behalf of the South Dakota Department of Transportation and two of its employees, Kent Gates and Chris Royalty, together with Mr. Schneider and Mr. Dabney. This case requires the court to consider two legal issues, one related to the merits, a duty argument that arises in the context of an accident involving highway maintenance or repair, and the other issue, a sovereign immunity argument that draws on the distinction between discretionary and ministerial conduct. Both of those are purely legal issues, but the facts related to the standards that apply deserve close attention from the court. And the facts essentially are undisputed in this case, but occasionally there are references to industry standards. And industry standards are not what the court applied below in determining that summary judgment was not appropriate here. And our argument is that industry standards don't apply. So overall, I want to make the point that I think the duty argument and the sovereign immunity arguments are independent, but to the extent that you try to rely on industry standards apart from the specifications, the statutes, the common law, that's where we get into the overlap between the sovereign immunity and the duty arguments.
So, Mr. Moore, are you asserting that the plaintiff here is limited to statutory duties, or that there's maybe some common law duties in this instance?
Yeah, our argument is clearly that there is no common law duty, that that was abrogated by the legislature as determined by this court in both the Dorman and the Holm decisions. And so for the...
Those are cases not involving state immunity. Those are involving local municipalities or counties, I think, and deal with specific statutes. Is there a case that you would cite that says this is a statutory duty?
Well, again,
other than those two?
No, Your Honor, but the statute is clear. The statutes at issue apply to governing body, and that amendment occurred, was made by the legislature from a specific reference to counties or townships. But secondly, in the scheme of the state and counties and municipalities, and this court has addressed this issue several times, the state stands at the top with respect to sovereign immunity.
But that's immunity, not duty.
Counties are, right. Well, true, but counties are creatures of the state. And to the extent that the immunity applies to a county and its employees, I don't know on what basis the court would say it doesn't apply to the state and its employees, especially when the argument that we're making based on statute clearly refers to the governing body, which would clearly include the state.
Counsel, don't we have state statutes here that pertain to highway maintenance by the state?
Correct.
So why isn't SDCL 3151 that says the DLT shall maintain and keep and repair all highways or portions of the highway on the state trunk highway system the source of the statutory duty? Understanding it's a different question whether it's discretionary or ministerial duty that would apply to the sovereign immunity question.
Well, in part, Your Honor, the answer is that as pleaded, the plaintiff did not rely on any statutory duties in this case. And as the case was decided by the circuit court said, I'm not relying on any statutory duties here. I'm relying on the common law. And
Does it matter? Does that govern? Does that restrict this court from determining whether or not there is a source of the duty alleged.
Well, if you follow Dorman and Holm, yes, it matters because the court has said that the legislature, I think it's like field preemption. The court has said that the legislature enacted a complete scheme with respect to the state's responsibility.
My question was, does it matter whether or not it was specifically pled? If the duty exists under a statute, but the plaintiff didn't specifically refer to it in their complaint, does that matter?
Well, it matters with respect to the application to the facts of this case, Your Honor. You can take the statute, but you still have to say, how does that apply to the facts of this case? And we don't have an argument before the court that the statute you cited creates a duty that was violated by the Department of Transportation in this case.
Well, so, you know, then we have other, so the court relied upon the circuit court on the standard specifications and the manual of uniform traffic control devices. So there are also statutes that direct that the Department of Transportation, 31-220, is directed that they adopt standard plans and specifications for highway maintenance. So that was something that the court relied on. The court also relied on the manual of traffic control devices, and we have a statute that imposes a duty on the department to erect and maintain these devices at points of danger. And again, I understand it's a different argument whether those are discretionary or ministerial, but why aren't those sources of the duty? The court was referring to those two things, and they are directed to statutory directives to the department.
In a very general sense, Your Honor, and I guess I would make this distinction with respect to highway maintenance. The DOT's standards specifications are about this thick. And if you rely on a general statute to say that the DOT has a responsibility to adopt standard specifications, and then you say from that, the standard specifications establish the standard of care, in every case, you have effectively subverted the rule in Dorman and Holm that the legislature occupied the field in this case and said that the DOT and counties and municipalities have liability only when there's a duty that's created by statute that's violated.
Would section 31-32-10 be helpful in establishing at least an argument or an allegation that a duty applied under a damaged or defective highway as it then existed theory?
I'm sorry, can you ask that again?
Yeah, what about a duty being sourced to STCL 31-32-10 under a theory that the highway as it then existed at the time of the accident was damaged or defective?
Well, again, it's not the theory that the case has proceeded under, Your Honor, and as a factual matter, you do have to get back to, and this is why the issues overlap, but you do have to get back to the question of what standard you're looking at and what are you relying on to say that this was ministerial. At the end of the day, you have to have both duty and you have to have ministerial conduct for there to be liability here. So in that sense, the standards overlap. But you can't start with duty and end there. You have to go back to discretionary versus ministerial.
So move there for a minute. Tell the court why you think this is discretionary and subject to immunity.
Sure. With respect to, first of all, Standardization 330.3E, which is the one that relates to tech application, first of all, factually, it was misread by the court. The court read it to say that the amount of tech that's applied has to match the amount of asphalt that's applied. That's not what it says. It says that the amount of tech has to conform to the estimate at the beginning of the day. There really isn't evidence on that. But secondly, I think it's really hard to suggest, Your Honor, that a standard that specifically allows for engineering discretion in terms of allowing the tack coat to exceed the amount of mat that's applied creates a ministerial duty. clearly the fact that discretion is part of the specification itself indicates that it's discretionary.
Are there some facts, but, though? Are there some facts in the record, though, at least factual dispute as to whether the discretion was even exercised here? In other words, were the employees even paying attention to and checking to see whether the amount of tax was, whether there was even an estimate made or whether there was a proper amount being laid down, those types of things? Isn't there some facts in the record that suggest that maybe nothing was even done in terms of the responsibility to make sure it was estimated correctly?
And I don't think that bears on the question whether that whether the standard establishes or relates to ministerial or discretionary conduct.
Well, isn't there a standard, though, that you're going to make sure that the right amount of tax is estimated and put down every day? I mean, isn't that a mandate on the employees doing that to make sure that they're estimating it and doing that?
It's a standard that applies as between the Department of Transportation and Spencer Quarries. It is not a ministerial standard because it allows for discretion, and it's undisputed in this case. And in fact, McGee makes this point over and over again, that the DOT allowed tack coat that was in excess of the mat at the end of the day, and that the DOT allowed traffic to drive on it because in the DOT's view, it's perfectly safe. There's nothing unsafe or dangerous about it. That's a matter of discretion for the Department of Transportation, and is perfectly consistent with the standard. But further, if you go to consider whether conduct is discretionary or ministerial, I think you go to paragraphs 21 and 22 of the Truman decision. And this is certainly pointed out in our brief, but the standard established in Truman is quite clear. It says that an act is ministerial if there is a compulsory response required by fixed designated facts. You have to have direct adherence to a governing rule or standard with a compulsory result. And there is no, it's an if-then proposition, and there is no if-then proposition that follows from standard specification 330.3E. There's nothing that says if the tack coat exceeds the amount of asphalt applied at the end of the day, then what? Nothing that says you put a sign up, nothing that says you put sand down, nothing that says you have to reroute traffic, nothing that says that you reduce the speed limit. That does not follow as a matter of an imperative, an absolute certainty that nothing remains for judgment or discretion. That's the Truman standard. And that's what has to apply to 330.E. It's what has to apply to the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. It's what has to apply to the Hot Mix Handbook, assuming that the Hot Mix Handbook applies at all, which we've not conceded. And that's the basis on which I think the court can decide simply that the conduct here is discretionary and not ministerial. If you look at the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, it says guidance. The fresh oil sign shall be road users of this surface treatment. On its face, it's not compulsory. It says guidance, and it says should be used. It's permissive. It's not mandatory. I would also suggest that it doesn't apply as a factual matter, and this is a legal determination that the court makes, but it's based on the fact that we're not talking about fresh oil here. By definition, broken tack, which is what Mr. McGee was driving on the day after its application, is not fresh oil. It's not wet. It's hardened. It's dried out. The emulsification is that it's dried. There's no suggestion it's wet. It's not fresh oil. So why would you put up a fresh oil sign? It's a non sequitur. With respect to the Hot Mix Handbook, how does that create, again, I'm now going back and forth between the duty and the discretionary versus ministerial conduct, but it's not incorporated into the contract. Assuming that it applies, again, it doesn't meet the Truman definition of ministerial conduct. There's no if-then statement, and it especially is absolutely full of permissive language. It says if traffic must travel over the tack coat before the overlay. Before the overlay. Now, we're talking about wet tack. We're not talking about broken tack here. Then there are things you can do. You can apply a light layer of sand. How do we get from that to a ministerial duty that the DOT should have applied sand to broken tack the next day? It's like saying when you buy a shuffleboard for your house, and it comes with sand that you put on the surface of the shuffleboard that allows the pucks to go back and forth more easily. It doesn't require expertise to suggest that sand applied to broken tack is not going to make the surface less slippery.
Same answer, same analysis if the accident occurs at 4 p.m. on Friday.
At what time?
4 p.m. on Friday. Instead of the following Saturday morning?
Well, 4 p.m. on Friday, I don't know if the tack was broken or not, Your Honor.
5:30.
Pardon?
5:30, whenever. I mean,
you're assuming it's broken or not broken?
I'm assuming it's wet.
Well, if you're assuming it's, but completely different facts, Your Honor. Now the DOT is allowing traffic to drive on tack before it is cured, before it is broken, and that's not the facts of this accident.
Well, it was a purely academic sort of thought, but he was prompted by the idea that it matters significantly, perhaps in this case, although I don't know if it does. Maybe it doesn't even matter to your ministerial discretionary argument if it's all guidance and all discretionary in any event.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's true.
Okay. What your time, with Mr. Minister.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Parsons, you can proceed with your initial argument, or your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court and my friend, Mr. Moore. The questions in this case are whether individual South Dakota Department of Transportation employees owe any legal duties to the public traveling on the highways that they are resurfacing, and if so, are they protected from tort liability for the violation of those duties by sovereign immunity? Now, the balancing of those competing equities involved in those considerations worked itself out over the course of hundreds of years in the English common law in a great compromise, essentially providing that while the king could not be held liable in the courts without his royal permission, his officers and his ministers could. And that compromise was incorporated into our democratic republic in the United States, and it translated into the general understanding that while a state or a public entity may not be held liable in its own courts for tort liability without its consent, its officers and employees may be held liable in tort for their violation of ministerial duties to the public with or without the state's permission.
So, Mr. Parsons, this is a little different case than the Holm case where we're suing the entity. Here we've got individual.
Exactly.
What's the difference in terms of the duty owed by the individuals versus the entity? Is there a difference?
Yeah, absolutely a difference, as this court explicitly explained in Dorman. But it goes back to State versus Ruth, which was 1896, 7 years after we became a state. And there, this court held, quote, an officer such as defendant was who, without legal excuse, fails to perform a merely ministerial duty is liable for the proximate results of his failure to any person to whom he owes performance of such a duty. And this court called that a firmly established proposition back in the 19th century. That's the compromise that we've made in these cases. And that's been the law in South Dakota since that time, and you can trace it from Ruth to Sioux Falls Construction to Lear to Bago to Kylo versus Panzer to Hansen to Wolf to Truman.
But most of those cases are immunity cases, not duty cases. Would you agree?
The focus tends to be immunity, but they are duty cases, some of them.
So do any of those cases speak specifically to the individual duty?
Absolutely. Kylo versus Panzer, that was the entire question in Kylo versus
Panzer.
That's
where they're driving a vehicle.
That was a traffic accident.
Or I think it was a snowplow.
Snowplow in violation of department policies. This case is
a little different than this situation. Anything in the construction area where we've talked about duty of an individual employee of an entity?
Sure. Smith versus Greek, Hansen, Wolf versus Sensed. And this case is a traffic accident. This, I mean, let's not forget.
Some of those are immunity cases, too.
Some are immunity cases, but all either assume duty or discuss duty.
And did those all deal with duties that were traced to statutory origin?
No, not necessarily, because in Kylo versus Panzer, this court said that the duty, an individual employee, when you make specific allegations that this specific individual employee, whether it's in the course of his or her employment or not, violated a ministerial duty, they're no different than any other person who violates a duty to the public. And this court cited our negligence law in Kylo versus Panzer.
Well, you know, one of them it dealt with, there were car accidents, or at least one of them was, where that's an ordinary duty that all of us have, regardless of whether we're a state employee or not. So we have the case law that says for state employees, suits against officers of the state while they're acting in that capacity are in reality suits against the state. So don't we have to have a source of the duty.
Yes, and the source, and they are in reality suits against the state. And for example, in Hansen, when the Secretary of Transportation was sued for something that happened on the ground. But the standard specifications that are binding on these employees, these specific employees, Mr. Gates and Mr. Royalty, impose a mandatory duty just as they did in Wolf versus Sensed.
So is it the standard specifications then that is the focus of your complaint, your client's complaint?
Yes. The standard specifications are policies embodied and incorporated into every contract developed by the state as part of their policymaking process.
So it's not quite the same thing with the hot mix handbook, though, is it?
No, it's not quite the same thing. That shows that there is that this is an extreme public safety issue matter, and so it plays into the factors that you develop, but it's the breach of the standard specifications and the requirements of the plan documents in combination with the requirements of the MUTCD, and those are all required, as you noted, Justice Devaney, by state statutes.
Well, not the contract itself, outside of vacations, though, correct?
Well, I think the contract creates duties as well. In combination with the specifications. I mean, the specifications are developed independently, and then they're incorporated into the contract. And so that creates a duty when it's ministerial. For example, I mean, we have to have a unified theory of what is a ministerial versus a discretionary duty. There's no statute saying you must drive safely, but there's still no sovereign immunity, and there's still a duty, even if you're doing that in the course of your employment, even if there's no specification that was violated. And this is the same. A standard can create, in our view, a ministerial duty. That's probably not all that common, but I think it can, as in the case of driving a car. But here we don't have that. We're not just left with that. We have these very specific standard specifications that have been violated, and they are ministerial. And these are ministerial, and they're very simple. You know, you could pluck someone off the street, as this court said, and they could apply what these very simple prohibitions are. It's not necessarily if then, as my friend was saying, it is you shall not do this unless. Just like in Wolf versus Sensed, you shall sand unless traffic is moving safely. Whether traffic is moving safely is discretionary, but you have to do it unless that applies. Just as in State versus Ruth, it's not the fact that they're using discretion in making the officer, the treasury or the financial officer is making an estimation, using judgment in making an estimation. It's that they're required to make the estimation. And if they don't do that,
where in 333.3E does it require that an estimate be made? It seems to infer that one may have been made, but that spec itself doesn't say you shall make an estimate every day.
Well, does it? I respectfully think it does, Your Honor. It says tack application ahead of mat laydown shall be limited by job conditions and shall not exceed the amount estimated for the current day's operation. Shall not exceed the amount estimated. So they have to estimate it. and they can't exceed the estimation. I completely agree with my friend's description of what the requirement is.
So if we assume that's true, you know, then it goes on to refer to unless ordered or allowed by the engineer. And
right.
So I think your opposing counsel is saying, voila, there's some discretion involved there.
Yeah, it's unless ordered or allowed by the engineer, and there's actually an interrogatory answer, a sworn interrogatory answer from the state, in this case, in the record stating, we have never ordered or allowed in excess of an estimation. Never.
But doesn't that go to whether the duty is breached instead of whether it in and of itself is a discretionary or a ministerial duty?
I respectfully don't think so, Your Honor, because the duty is imposed, it's mandatory, shall not, unless you order or allow it, and they didn't order or allow it. And in fact, as Chief Justice was raising, they didn't even care about it. The testimony in this case from Mr. Gates, Mr. Royalty, who had the specific responsibility to enforce these requirements, they said, we never really cared about that. That's the sworn testimony. We never looked at it. That wasn't an issue for us.
Under your rule, though, that would lead to widely disparate results, right? If you sourced a duty or the ability to hold somebody accountable in tort based upon whether someone exercised a discretionary function as opposed to whether they were authorized, that would put plaintiffs at sort of an arbitrary position whereby their recovery was, or their ability to recover would be limited to, you know, whether someone actually exercised the discretion or not, as opposed to whether they were able to.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. It limits recovery to precisely when they violate their own ministerial standards.
I had another question about this, about the estimate. And as I understand, and Chief mentioned it, but the idea that maybe they weren't estimating at all. I wondered about that as a logical matter. I mean, someone shot the tack in front of the paver. Maybe it wasn't a good estimate. Maybe it could have been more careful. But there was tack, and it was in front of the paver. Someone put it there for the day's work. Maybe they had too much. Maybe it wasn't accurate. But doesn't that strongly suggest, just a matter of logic, somebody estimated it? Maybe not well, but they did.
The testimony was we didn't, Your Honor, in this case. And so that brings us to point two of the ministerial duties. If for some reason the estimate is off, or they can't meet their ministerial duty to not cover more than was estimated, then there's a second requirement, mandatory requirement. Have it in the plans. For tack and flush seal operations, when flaggers are not being used, the fresh oil sign, W212, shall be displayed in advance of the liquid asphalt areas, and that implicates the MUTCD provision. Now, this idea that, wait a minute, it's not fresh. You should construe the word fresh on the sign according to its plain and ordinary meaning. This is an industry term, and this is all explained by our experts, and without exaggeration, these are the premier experts in the field of highway resurfacing. We have the author of the Hot Mix Handbook as one of our experts. Their expert reports in the appendix explain that this sign is required to warn of the surface treatment whatever the surface treatment is. There's not a different sign for each surface treatment. There's not a exposed tack sign and a different. What that sign is intended to do is to raise an ordinary member of the public who's coming by to alert them that there's a surface treatment there and they ought to exercise care and slow down.
But that would be a legal opinion, right? This is a duty question or a question of immunity. That's a legal opinion. Certainly that wouldn't bind a court.
No, it would not bind the court. It is what all the experts say. It's what the lower court who heard all the evidence found that it's not, and it's not, is it wet or not? The whole point, it's not wet. No one is driving on wet tack. I mean, you don't need a sign because no one drives on wet, unbroken tack. It's after it dries, the moisture's all out of it, and it, because there's no friction, as the experts testified in their reports, it takes on suddenly the friction of packed snow. So you're driving along a highway in the summer, and all of a sudden, without any warning, you're driving on what is the frictional equivalent of packed snow, and you lose control and you flip, and you devastating consequences result.
Council, there's a couple other provisions before we run out of time here would like you to address. The other standard specification that deals with the warning signs, 333G, says you shall provide signs and prevent traffic from traveling on freshly applied asphalt until it has penetrated. So that's actually language from the spec. So until it has penetrated, that seems a little more specific. How does that apply to what we have here?
Yeah, and that's not the specification that we relied on. And I don't think it overrides the requirement that it shall. I'm sorry.
That's the specific spec that deals with warning signs. How do you not rely upon them?
We rely upon the specification that says that the W212 sign, this is what we're talking about, the fresh oil sign.
Then when we go to that sign, that's listed as guidance. And the manual itself defines guidance as a statement of recommended but not mandated practice in typical situations with deviations allowed if in the engineering judgment the study indicates deviation to be appropriate. It also notes the verb shall and may are not used in guidance statements. Guidance statements are sometimes modified by options. So that doesn't sound like a mandatory directive there.
But it's mandatory unless there's some engineering reason not to use it, is basically what that says. But that's in combination then with our standard specifications and the plan documents here.
But doesn't
it says
that
you
allow,
shall use it.
Doesn't it in and of itself allow for discretion then?
To some degree, it does, that MUTCD standard, but you have to combine that with what the State Department of Transportation has done in its plan documents and its standard specifications, and they use the word shall be displayed in advance of the liquid asphalt areas.
That hasn't penetrated.
In a different provision, that hasn't penetrated, but I don't even know what penetrated means necessarily, but liquid asphalt doesn't mean it's wet. Again, that's a term of art. Liquid asphalt, it means it can be sprayed, like tack can be sprayed when you apply it. That's liquid asphalt. Dry liquid asphalt is still liquid asphalt that you applied and sprayed. It's still tack, and it's the removal of moisture that makes it dangerous. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Moore, you can proceed with your rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll go back to where I got to in the middle of my argument, which is that Truman provides the most important language with respect to the standard to distinguish ministerial from discretionary conduct. And what I did not hear in Mr. Parsons' argument is any indication where the compulsory result comes from any of these standards. None of them meet the Truman definition, and that's clearly the law, and it's clearly easy to apply.
We've addressed these seven factors for discretionary ministerial in a number of cases. What's your view of the relevancy of those factors?
So we cited them, Your Honor, to the circuit court, both in the briefing on the motion to dismiss and in the summary judgment argument. Judge Anderson relied on them. My argument's a little different to this court. I don't think they're terribly helpful. They're frequently not applied by the court in this case. As is evident from our brief, we went through the factors and came to the opposite conclusion of Judge Anderson with respect to those factors.
So then let me ask you this. You're saying you don't think they're particularly helpful. Why would you not apply them in this case?
Well, you can apply them, and I think based on the argument we made, if you do apply them, they favor our side of the case. Well, what I think is clear is the language in the Truman standard, which requires an imperative and it requires a compulsory result. It has this if-then framework that's easy to apply.
If that's the case, then what's the use or what's the purpose of the seven factors? If that's mandatory, how do we even apply those seven factors?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor. It's part of the argument about why
suggest,
I think.
How would you suggest we apply it?
Well, I think you can walk away from them if you don't think that they're helpful or that they potentially contradict the Truman standard. And Your Honor, part of the evidence I think that they're not that helpful is the circuit court relied on them to grant summary judgment to Jay Pepple in this case, but not to the other two employees. Go look at the First Amendment amended complaint and read the allegations against the three. They're the same. And the circuit court did that just because Mr. Pepple was higher up in the managerial framework, and therefore presumably he had more discretion to exercise. But part of that is based on the factors, and I think it gets a little bit amorphous and a little bit hard to apply.
Less workable.
Sorry, you like the short because well, it tells us here's the test.
Absolutely. And at the end of the day, the part of the argument about what's wrong with the circuit court's analysis and result in this case is it's not consistent with the Truman standard. And so if you just apply the factors and don't apply the Truman standard and say, where's the compulsory result based on fixed designated facts, then it seems to me that there's some conflict between the factors and the standard. To the extent that the factors go to the issue of the purpose of immunity in the first place, which is that one branch of government does not step on the shoes of another branch, I'll go back to Justice Salter's question about, wasn't the estimation actually done in this case? And I would say not only was the estimate done in this case on a daily basis, but if there was excess tack at the end of the day that was not covered by the mat, that was de facto allowed by the Department of Transportation. There's no dispute about that. The department's position is it's not unsafe to drive on broken tack. That's a discretionary call by the Department of Transportation that if this court is going to say, as a matter of law, for purposes of determining whether the conduct is ministerial or discretionary, we accept as true that it's unsafe, now the court has made a policy decision for the executive branch of government. And to the extent that the factors are a part of that analysis, I think it is helpful to think about that. I just want to get to one last point with respect to industry standards. And Justice Devaney, this goes to your question about the difference between the standard spec and the hot mix handbook. If you look at the Appley's brief on page 12, there's a citation to a standard that talks about reducing speed limit to 20 miles per hour, and it cites to page 352 of the record. If you go to that, it is an excerpt from an expert report put together for the plaintiff, but it cites the Asphalt Institution publication MS-19, a basic asphalt emulsion manual. It cites a Caltrans publication on tack coat guidelines, and it cites a provision from the Flexible Pavements of Ohio in their technical bulletin. What Mr. McGee is arguing here is that industry standards apply and determine the duty that was owed in this case. And I think for that to be true, you have to get around Dorman, you have to get around Home, you have to say that the common law applies because industry standards are irrelevant if the source of duty has to be statutory with respect to highway maintenance and repair. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both counsel for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes. Thank you.